Dr. Michael Mosley is best known for his books about intermittent fasting to lose weight and to improve health. The Fast Diet, his first, was a huge bestseller in 2013. Several more followed. His latest is another fast book, Fast Asleep, it's called, which sounded good to me. Quite easy not to eat while asleep, for most. But no, this one is about how to get a really good night's rest, which some of us are having trouble with right now, what with the anxiety of it all. Dr. Mosley is, of course, a well-known TV personality as well as an author, and he's with us on Skype. Hello.
Hi there. Good morning.
I need to ask you how you are, because I think both your sons have been confirmed as having COVID-19, have they not?
That's right. And they're both very well. They're both in their 20s, and they lost the sense of smell and taste, and that's slowly coming back. One of them is a junior doctor, and he started today in the intensive care unit, which is really the kind of front line. And so I'm quite relieved that he's had it, because that means he has a high degree of immunity. And he said it's quite quiet at the moment, but we're expecting a hell of a lot more cases in the next couple of weeks.
What about you and your wife, Claire? Have you been tested?
We have not been tested, but we've had no symptoms, so I can only assume we're fine. And despite the fact that my other son, Daniel, has been living with us for a couple of weeks now, he actually got it in Australia, came back from Melbourne, and it turned out that his two flatmates were both doctors, both tested positive for COVID-19 the day after he left. So he brought it back with him. He had it, but neither of us have had anything. So I can only assume we may well have some degree of immunity.
You've been making a documentary about the coronavirus from home, I'm assuming.
Yes. Well, I was originally, I did do some filming with a group at Imperial College. It's in St. Mary's Hospital, and indeed the lab is just above the lab where Alexander Fleming discovered penicillin. And so they are, and that was in 1928. And this group here are now trying to develop a vaccine against the coronavirus. And it's pretty remarkable because in 2.5 weeks, they were able to create a prototype vaccine, which they've tested on animals, on rats, and now on monkeys. And they're going to be moving on to human trials. So something which would ordinarily have taken 5 years, they've managed to do in less than 3 weeks.
Nevertheless, for public consumption, it's going to be, what, 18 months fastest for a vaccine?
They reckon they can get 5 million doses out by September, if all goes right.
Really?
Yeah.
Crikey, that is
so safe. They're the first group I've ever come across who claim to be able to do something like this, but we shall see. Obviously, it depends on it all going well and the human trials going well, but it's a very different technique using something called an RNA vaccine. That's pretty phenomenal.
All right. And what lab is this based at, Michael?
It's Imperial College, London.
Right. Okay. Pending that vaccine then, and to the subject of your book, sleep is vital to give us a good chance of fighting off the virus. What's the link between sleep and the immune system?
Essentially, one of the things we now know is that sleep is profoundly important for the immune system. It is when you're in deep sleep that your body produces and releases things called cytokines, also killer T cells and antibodies. And they did a pretty remarkable experiment a couple of years ago in the States, where they took 140 volunteers and they measured their sleep using activity monitors. And then they brought them in the lab and they squirted common cold virus up their nostrils. And then they kept them in isolation for a week to see who would get the cold and who wouldn't. And they continued to monitor their sleep. And it turned out that those who slept for less than 6 hours a night were 4 times more likely to get the common cold than those who didn't. So this was a group, all of whom were exposed to exactly the same level of virus. But the ones who were not sleeping well were the ones who were unable to fight it off. And as I said, they were 4 times more likely to actually come down with a cold than those sleeping 7 hours. And that shows you really how remarkably important sleep is for maintaining your immune system in good shape.
But what happens when you sleep to boost your immune system?
Well, one of the things, as I was saying, is in deep sleep, your body produces these things called cytokines. Now, your body in deep sleep produces an awful lot of really helpful substances, including growth hormone. So you kind of, particularly when you're a teenager, you'll grow during your sleep, which is why it's so important to sleep. But they produce these things called cytokines and also T killer cells. So what normally happens is the first line of defense when a virus invades your system is the cytokines are activated, and then the antibodies are released to try and grapple, if you like, with the virus. And then the T killer cells come along and they kill infected cells.
What are cytokines exactly, Michael, though?
Sorry?
What are cytokines?
Cytokines are basically a type of protein which help to coordinate the activity of your immune system. Now, one of the things that kills you when you get COVID-19, particularly when you're older, is a thing called a cytokine storm. One of the things that we know happens as you get older is your immune system gets weaker, probably because you're sleeping worse. We know as you get older, people typically get less deep sleep, and therefore they produce less of the helpful elements to the immune system. And so what happens in older people is they don't mount a good enough immune response early on, and then they grossly overact. And you get this thing called a cytokine storm, where the cytokines and all sorts of things go a bit crazy. And at that point, the virus is in your lungs, and your body launches effectively a nuclear attack on the virus. But by that point, it is so destructive. The immune reaction is so destructive that it basically knackers your lungs, and that's why you die. So in the end, you actually die as a result of your own immune system malfunctioning, if you like, in response to the coronavirus.
So if older people got more sleep, would that make that less likely?
I think that certainly would. We know that sleep is profoundly important at all stages of life. I don't know if anyone's actually done a study on it, but as I said, we know how important. And we also know that if you don't get enough sleep, you tend to have a lower life expectancy. And one way it operates could well be via the action on the immune system. And that's why I wanted really to write this book. I wrote it a while ago. I wasn't obviously anticipating COVID-19 or this coronavirus happening, but I knew that good quality sleep was incredibly important, particularly for things like your brain. But again, a really novel bit of research has shown that during deep sleep, channels open up in your brain and cerebrospinal fluid flushes through your brain and it washes out all the gunk. So your brain literally cleans itself during deep sleep. And this was something that was not known even 2 or 3 years ago. And that could well be, again, why people who are older are at higher risk of developing dementia. It's the buildup of the gunk in the brain, which seems to be linked to dementia, and the poor quality sleep that people get as they get older seems to be, as I said, implicated in the fact that you're not cleaning out your brain as efficiently as you were when you were younger.
Yes,
so sleep does remarkable things for your body, but also for your brain.
I read that flushing thing in your book. It sounds completely disgusting. Why is it that older people sleep less or feel they need less sleep?
They don't feel like they do because people often fall asleep during the day. I mean, the key measure of whether you're getting enough sleep is, do you fall asleep during the day? There is a test called the sleep deprivation. Well, basically what you do is you go to bed in the middle of the afternoon, you set your alarm for 15 minutes and close your eyes. And if you fall asleep within 15 minutes, you have a problem. You are sleep deprived. Or if, like my dad, and indeed what I used to do, I'd fall asleep in the cinema, or I'd fall asleep in the theater or over dinner. And that was because I just wasn't getting enough sleep. That really is the best test we have, because the range, the amount of sleep that people need varies enormously from person to person. Some people can get by on 4 or 5 hours a night. Some people need 7 or 8. So as I said, that is one of the best measures we have. Do you fall asleep when you're given the chance?
Sorry, I just dozed off there for a moment. Less sleep and shorter life. You made that statement a little earlier, and I just want to ask you about it. How do you know that people who are not very well sleep less, and they're going to have a shorter life because they're not very well, not because they get less sleep?
Sure. I mean, the reason we know it, obviously, there are these associations, but if you sleep deprive rats, then they die. We know from animal studies, clearly you can't do it with humans. But we know shift workers also die in much higher numbers and much earlier, and they suffer from all sorts of chronic diseases. And that is partly to do with the fact they are sleep deprived. They're not getting as much good quality sleep. It's also to do with the messing up of their internal clocks. And I write quite a lot about that, because your internal clocks are hugely important for maintaining your health. So unfortunately, if you're a shift worker, and I do write a good old chunk on shift workers, because one of my sons is a shift worker, being a junior doctor, but also I used to do a lot of shift work when I was doing medicine. And so it's a subject that's dear to my heart. And around 20% of the working population in New Zealand will be shift workers, doctors, nurses, paramedics, and all sorts of people working in the aviation industry and things like that. And they get no support at all. I've spoken to lots of fire officers, police officers, and none of them get any advice on how to cope with shift work. And yet we know that shift work is absolutely devastating for your system.
You are an insomniac, which is why you're obsessed with sleep and why you've written this book. Do you think that one of the reasons for that is the shift work, or is there something else going on?
I think there's a strong genetic component. I'm much better now, but I have had my genes tested, and I fall into the category of people who, when they get stressed, sleep especially badly. I was kind of fine when I was young, and then I had four kids, and then I got a responsible job, and then I woke up at 3 o'clock every morning worrying about stuff, and that's when I became an insomniac. And I made quite a few programs about sleep, but I've been kind of waiting to write this book until I found something that would actually work, because I wanted to write a book which would offer genuine solutions. So everything I've written about, I have tried, and I'm delighted to say I am no longer an insomniac. So I'm sleeping pretty well these days.
I want to talk specifically about shift workers, but I want to talk about what wakes people up. Like, I know a lot of people are sleeping less easily these days. I myself wake up approximately every 2 hours or every hour and a half and look at the clock and then read a bit and then go back to sleep again. What is it that makes that happen?
That is largely habit. So what happens, I mean, typically
it's a new habit. It's a new habit. It never happened before.
No, quite. I mean, I think there are other things going on. We know, for example, that your microbiome, your gut bacteria, have a crucial role to play in sleep. And I write about that, and that's kind of new stuff. But one of the things that happens is people get into a pattern of waking up, because what happens is every 90 minutes during the night, you have a cycle. You fall through stages of sleep, from light sleep through to deep sleep and then up again. So you surface. It's a bit like being a free diver. You dive in there and then you come up again. Every 90 minutes or so, you come back to the surface. Now, in the good old days, you never noticed that, because you would just dive deep again, and then you would have another 90 minutes and you'd come up, and then you'd start to have some REM sleep, some rapid eye movement sleep, and it seemed like you were sleeping the whole night. In reality, you weren't. You were waking up, but only briefly, and then you started to wake up, and then you started to notice that you were waking up, and then you started to worry about the fact that you were waking up, and then you got into that habit. And that habit is the problem. And that's, I guess, why my book is largely about how do you break that habit. Because, unfortunately, it is a pattern. 90 minutes is exactly how we sleep. And one way of looking at it is they have done studies on the Hadza hunter-gatherers who sleep a nomadic lifestyle. They live a nomadic lifestyle in places like Tanzania. They've studied three groups of hunter-gatherers. They all kind of hang around the campfire, and then a couple of hours later, they head off to sleep. But they also wake up, they wander around in the middle of the night, they go back to sleep, they wander around, and they only get about 6 hours of actual sleep a night. The rest of the time, they're kind of wandering around. So if you actually look at what our ancestors did, they did something like that. They spent a lot of their time kind of waking up and wondering. And indeed, once upon a time in pre-industrial age, it was perfectly normal to wake up in the middle of the night, have a bit of a party, maybe a bit of sex, bit of drink, maybe do some, you know, stuff like that, and then go back to sleep.
Okay.
Whereas now we see...
No, I'll try that. Anything. Yes, that sounds like a good solution. Hey,
there was a French book, 18th century French book, which basically said the best time to have sex, to have babies, was between the first and the second sleep, i.e. around 3 a.m.
Really? So it was quite normal to sleep in two blocks?
Oh, yes. The idea of sleeping in a block is a very modern thing.
All right. People who are suffering from insomnia, and they seem to have suffered from it for years. I'm saying that it's probably worse at the moment, but generally it seems like a chronic condition. What are the main things they should do?
Sure. So one of the things they need to do is set a pattern. So you get up the same time every morning. Another thing is to expose yourself to plenty of bright light first thing in the morning. I actually bought a light box to make sure I get enough bright light. That's to reset your circadian clock. The other is to make sure that your diet is a sort of Mediterranean-style diet, which is rich in fiber and legumes and lentils and things like that. It's a tasty way of eating, lots of recipes in the book. But critically, it's also very important for reducing stress and anxiety. There have been a number of big studies in Australia demonstrating this from the Food and Mood Centre in Melbourne. They did a study very recently in students where they randomly allocated half of them to going on this Mediterranean-style diet. And within 3 weeks, their levels of depression and anxiety had halved. So it seems to be also very important because it changes your microbiome, your gut bacteria, reduces inflammation in the brain and things like that. And the other thing is when you wake at 3 a.m, you should, if you don't feel going back to sleep, then you should get out of bed. And you should read a book until you feel sleepy. But also paradoxically, and this is also in the book, some people benefit from cutting back their sleep. So you actually do what's called sleep restriction therapy for a short period of time. And that way you guarantee you're pretty tired. So when you go to bed, you sleep well and you sleep deeply. And so you cut down your sleep to, say, 6 or 7 hours. And then you gradually increase it again as your sleep drive improves. And this is kind of rebooting your brain, breaking down the bad habits that you have acquired. Because what's happened is you have got used to the idea that when you go to sleep, you will wake up and you will fret about it. And this is a way of basically breaking that cycle. So, and there's also a section about stress reduction and things like that, breathing exercises and stuff like that, which is very effective. I'm afraid counting sheep are completely useless because it's not demanding enough cognitively. You just get bored very quickly.
Just the sleep restriction or SRT, sleep restriction therapy, just talk me through that in a little more detail, please.
Sure. So we've known this. I mean, studies on this have been done since the 1980s. And the idea here is that you cut down. So say you typically go to bed for 8 hours. You go to bed at 11 and wake up at 7 and you spend a fair amount of that time waking up and going to sleep, waking up and going to sleep. What you do instead is you cut down to about 6 hours. So you go to bed a couple of hours later. You go to bed at 1 a.m. and you get up at 7. And you do that for about a week. You do not allow yourself to have any sort of dozing off time in the afternoon. You don't have a nap. And that way, basically, you massively increase your sleep drive. And if at the end of the week you're pretty well sleeping through the night, you're getting your 6 hours of pretty solid sleep, then you can increase it by 20 minutes. And you do that for another week, and then you gradually increase it. This is probably the most effective way of treating insomnia. And the studies show more effective than drugs, more effective than anything else. And interestingly, a New Zealand study a few months ago showed that it can be done. General practitioners can teach you how to do it. You can do it from the book, frankly. And it was much more effective in this study done in New Zealand general practice than drugs or indeed any other form of therapy. The problem is that the sleep industry is huge and most of the stuff they flog does not work.
Sleep restriction therapy then. And that resets your passions, breaks your habit.
That's the one. And what it does is it kind of teaches your brain to associate bed with sleep. And as I said, one of the fundamental problems is people start to they start to get anxious, they wake up, they fear going to bed. And it's almost like a phobia. And what you need to do that, again, with phobias, what you do is you do what's called systematic desensitization. And this is kind of a similar idea. I'm surprised it is very well known in the sleep circles, but very little known outside sleep circles. And so I was kind of rather gobsmacked that other people haven't written about it. Because I've read quite a few books about how terrible, you know, how the damaging effects the lack of sleep have on your brain and your body. But I've read almost nothing which tells you what to do, what you can do about it.
A lot of people are asking about medication. Do sleeping pills enable you to have a good night's sleep effectively? I suspect you're going to say no. What?
They do, certainly initially. Okay. I mean, you know, the problem is, and it's, you know, a perfectly reasonable thing to do, particularly if the reason why is because, you know, you've lost your job, you're stressed, maybe you've lost a loved one, all the things which are going on at the moment. Then GPs, doctors will prescribe them. The trouble is that the effects start to wear off. I mean, one of the pills that I take occasionally is melatonin. Now, you can't buy it over the counter in the UK, but it is available as a vitamin supplement in the States. So you can buy it quite legally that way. And there have been numerous studies showing that melatonin, particularly for people over the age of about 55, really does improve the quality of sleep. And it seems to have almost no side effects. And the other thing is you don't get habituated to it, unlike sleeping pills. So I do occasionally use sleeping pills, particularly when I'm traveling, but doctors will not prescribe them for long periods of time just because you get habituated, you get used to them.
You mentioned shift workers earlier. Specifically, what advice would you give to them, given that they are limited as to what they can do with their sleeping times?
Sure. I think one of the bits of advice is try and do, if you're, for example, doing a night shift, do try and get your shift sleeping in the afternoon, not in the morning. Don't go to sleep straight away. Do try and expose yourself to some bright light at work. Take in a lamp which gives you 10,000 lux at some point. That's going to be more stimulating than having a cup of coffee. And try doing what's called time-restricted eating. Bring in some good quality food to eat, because the problem with shift workers is they often eat junk. And we know, for example, that if you're a fire officer or a police officer, then you're more likely to die as a result of shift work and the junk food you eat than you are from a fire or from anything else. You're more likely to die in a car crash on your way home, frankly. There is a thing called time-restricted eating, where what you do is you try and go for a kind of longish period without eating. And, for example, there is a big study being done in Australia at the moment looking at the impact of that on heart disease. So again, if you're a shift worker, what you might do is you might try and stop eating at around, say, 1 a.m. and then not eat again until 8 or 9 a.m. and in between just have plenty of water. So that seems to be beneficial for shift workers. One of the worst things that shift workers do is they just eat a load of junk. And I understand why, because their body is completely out of kilter. But the important thing is to kind of get their digestive system, if you like, in kilter with their internal clock. And their internal clock is telling them, don't eat all this junk now, because it's, if you eat late at night or you eat in the middle of the night, then your blood sugars and your blood fats basically just soar and soar and soar. And it's going to move you down the road to heart disease and dementia.
Mm. Which doesn't augur well for my habit of getting up at midnight and going to the fridge and getting the chocolate out.
I'm afraid not. Nope. I would strongly advise you to try and break that habit if you possibly can. Have a small handful of nuts instead. That may not sound marvellous, but the fibre would be better. And if you can avoid, my wife, who's a parasomniac, she's a GP, she does a lot of sleepwalking, sleep talking, stuff like that. So my kids are also, it's inherited. So they do a lot of wandering around in the middle of the night. She frequently kind of turns all the lights off and starts looking for patients under the bed.
Is
I have
there
to gently go, no, I have to join in. I used to argue with her, which was utterly pointless. And now I just join in and go, oh, yes, there's no one here, is there? And then she goes back to sleep. She never, ever remembers the next morning.
Gosh, isn't that interesting?
When she wakes up in the middle of the night, she sometimes goes off and has a handful of nuts, and that kind of seems to calm her down. Parasomnia is really, really interesting.
It is interesting. Very quickly.
The whole of sleep is unbelievably interesting.
The statement, an hour of sleep before midnight is worth 2 hours after. Does that make any sense?
Sort of. I mean, the idea there is that you go through different phases of sleep, as I was saying, and generally speaking, during the first half of the night, you get your deep sleep, and the deep sleep is particularly important for your immune system, for growth hormone, and also for your brain, cleaning out your brain, as I said, and also for sorting out your memories. And in the second half of the night, that's when you do REM sleep, rapid eye movement sleep. And that's when you get in most of your dreams. And that's also, the dreams seem to be an important part of emotional rebalancing. Your dreams are almost like a form of therapy. So it is important to kind of get both phases, but deep sleep is particularly important. And and the evidence seems to be that you get most of your deep sleep in the early hours. And they did do a study with students where they got them to sleep either between 10 p.m. and 7 a.m. or between 2 a.m. and 12 p.m. And the ones, and they were healthier when they were getting the earlier sleep.
And more detail indeed in Dr. Michael Mosley's Fast Asleep, How to Get a Really Good Night's Rest. Thank you.